Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello and welcome to another episode in the New Books and Gender Studies podcast. I am one of your co-hosts, Kyle McMillan, and today I have the pleasure of talking to Heath Vaugh Davis with his new book, Beyond Trans, Does Gender Matter? Professor, how are you doing today?
Hello, I'm doing...
Hello and welcome to another episode in the New Books and Gender Studies podcast. I am one of your co-hosts, Kyle McMillan, and today I have the pleasure of talking to Heath Vaugh Davis with his new book, Beyond Trans, Does Gender Matter? Professor, how are you doing today?
Hello, I'm doing well. Thanks, Kyle. Good to be here.
Yeah, so I just wanted to start out with sort of your background academically and otherwise, and sort of how you got to the point where you are writing about gender and this sort of idea of going beyond trans.
Sure. So without giving sort of going the long version of the story, because we have limited time, just a little bit of background. So I'm an associate professor at Temple University, and I teach in the political science department, and I always have, but I've always had strong interest in both gender theory and African-American political thought, race and political theory. And I've been interested throughout my career in instances of discrimination that don't necessarily pop up on the radar screen as obvious. And so often these are kinds of forms of discrimination that might seem like private acts of discrimination versus public that we don't necessarily attend to. So I've written about discrimination in transracial adoption, for instance. That was my first book. And this book rose out of that same kind of train of thinking about what are sort of forms of gender identity discrimination that we don't typically maybe think of, and so ways to bring a spotlight onto those instances of discrimination. And also my activism. I do a lot of trans activism in the city of Philadelphia. I'm on the Mayor's Commission for LGBT Affairs here in the city, and have worked for probably almost a decade on various aspects of trans politics, both here in Philadelphia and throughout the nation. So that's just sort of a little bit of my background coming to write the book. I also, as an openly trans person, I also wanted to include some autobiographical details in the book to add a kind of human element to it. The book is really a series of case studies where I really try to center trans experience.
Well, one of the really interesting things you talk about bringing in the human experience that I found particularly interesting is that, see, you kind of outline different instances where folks are either being questioned for their sex or their gender or both. And it seems like that questioning or that policing seems to be very akin to how many researchers have talked about, like, border crossings, almost kind of like in immigration studies, and sort of who gets the authority to make, you know, those inspections. I don't know if you wanted to talk a little bit about that, sort of how that power is dispersed.
Sure. I think that's really insightful. And that's exactly kind of what I'm focusing on in the book. I begin with this a story, which I think is very powerful. Here in the city of Philadelphia, for our public transportation system, which is called SEPTA, and short for, you know, Southeastern Pennsylvania Transit Authority, had a policy for several decades where they required that anybody who bought a monthly bus pass had to have a gender sticker on the pass, so either an M for male or an F for female. And this caused trouble, not just for trans people, we'll get to in a second, but also for anybody who wasn't gender conforming for whatever reason. And I tell the story of Charlene Arcilla, who was an African-American transgender woman who tried to use a bus pass that had an F sticker because she self-identified as female and was turned away by a bus operator who told her that she wasn't real. She was not a real female, a real woman, so she couldn't use the pass. Charlene, the friend of mine, she sadly passed away a couple of years ago, but worked in the city on trans rights, and so was an activist at the same time that she was a bus rider. So she came back with a male marked bus pass and tried to use that, and she was turned away by another bus operator who told her that she wasn't a man. So it put her in this no-win kind of situation. She couldn't use either pass. And I begin with the story because I think it goes to the main argument of the book, which is any time when you have a sex classification policy, a gender policy, you are transferring the authority to our own self-authority to say who we are in relation to gender categories to somebody else who then has the power, just like a border inspector, to say that you either meet the standards or you don't. And what was interesting about the bus case, the bus pass case, is that, of course, the employees of SEPTA were never given any instruction as to how to do a gender inspection. And then as you start to talk about this, then it becomes, you know, most people can see how ludicrous it is to even put a bus operator or any employee in that position where they're making those kinds of decisions. Charlene brought a case against SEPTA in the city. We have gender identity as a protected category, like a lot of cities and municipalities do. So she brought a legal claim, a legal case against the bus company. The bus company dragged its heels for a long, long time. Eventually it got rid of the sex stickers in 2013, but it never admitted that it had violated Charlene Arcilla's civil rights. So I think that the story is powerful because if the sex stickers on bus passes seem ridiculous to us, then what about, it made me think about our driver's licenses and our passports and our birth certificates. Are the gender stickers really necessary in those instances as well, or do they just trigger sex identity discrimination, as we saw in Charlene's case?
Right, and kind of, you know, going along with your main argument that's laid out in the introduction, what do you outline as sort of the problem with correction when it comes to these policies?
Yeah, I think, you know, correction has been the dominant narrative that mainstream trans civil rights organizations have used. And while I see a lot of value and I support them and I see the strategic value, which we could talk about in a minute, but the problem with the kind of correction strategy is that it's based on assimilation. It assumes, number one, a kind of a stereotypical narrative of trans identity, which is sort of this born in the wrong body kind of narrative, which resonates with some people, but not everybody. So there's that part of it. And I think that whenever you're trying to assimilate people into existing categories, there will always be people who either don't want to assimilate into those categories, or, and perhaps this is the more sort of important or more sort of alarming part of it, there are those people who can't, that won't be believed. And so going back to Charlene Ursula again, and what I think is the radical essence of her legal complaint against the bus company, is that her bus pass was corrected. You know, so she had an F marker for female, and she identified as a woman. And so, you know, that had been corrected, quote unquote, yet she wasn't believed in these particular instances. And I will just point out also that the vast majority of bus drivers did not give her a problem. And so I think that's another key part of this, that it's not so much that, that we want to sort of say that anybody put in this position to carry out a gender inspection will use that power to discriminate against somebody. I don't think that that's true. I think that most people don't intend harm on trans people. But the problem with that scenario was that there were a few bus drivers who did use their power that way. And that creates a kind of a horrible kind of, situation where you never know when this could happen. So here's somebody who is just trying to use public transportation to get to their job, to wherever they had to go, and to always have to board the bus and have that kind of fear that this could be one of the bad days, not just being turned away, but also in a lot of cases, trans people and gender nonconforming people were loudly questioned by bus operators so that other passengers could hear them. And this created a really unsafe kind of atmosphere where then the person has to worry about whether other passengers are going to hassle them either on the bus or follow them off the bus. And so a lot of people told stories about how they were negatively impacted by such a seemingly benign policy.
And I think it's important to make clear to our listeners, too, that the argument that you're laying out in this book and sort of why we should question these sex classification policies is that if we start to dismantle them, it's better off for everyone, including sort of cisgender, gender-conforming people. So I don't know if you want to sort of outline how your argument kind of plays into that, how getting rid of sex classification or modifying the policies benefits everyone.
Yeah, I'm glad that you brought that up. I think, and I say this right at the beginning of the book, that we as a society would be much better off as a collective, if we drastically reduce the number of sex classification policies that we have. And so there are benefits to trans individuals, but there are also benefits to non-trans people as well. And if you think about the example of public restrooms, which is one of the chapters in the book and has been obviously in the news, on the public radar, sex-segregated public restrooms, number one, they harm certain trans people. So we have to be clear, I think, about how we define transgender discrimination. Somebody like me, a transgender man who's pretty gender-conforming, I've not been hassled when trying to use a men's room. However, prior to transitioning, and it's been almost a decade now, I had a lot of times when I was questioned in women's bathrooms because I was either, androgynous or masculine-presenting woman. So we have to be clear and specific about gender identity discrimination and what that looks like in actuality. There are some people who are trans who experience transgender discrimination in various ways, and there are others who don't. And then there are cisgender people who experience transgender discrimination or gender identity discrimination, and those who don't. In the public bathroom scenario, there are other people in particular, you know, we can think about gender identity discrimination, but also just kind of traditional forms of sexism. So we know that women and girls have to, on average, spend longer amounts of time waiting for public restrooms, especially in crowded venues like stadiums and, you know, I don't know, like rest stops on the highway and so on. And that has to do with the fact that there's inequity, there are differences in how men's bathrooms are constructed with urinals and how men, you know, how long it takes men and women to use a public restroom. So I think that if you go back to the 1990s, there were all these cases, the so-called potty parity cases, where non-transgender women brought lawsuits against concert venues and the like based on this inequity. And some of the remedies to that were to say, well, okay, we'll build X number of additional stalls for women. But that it never ended up equalizing things completely. And so I make this point that whenever you have sex-segregated facilities, whether it's public restrooms or sports or any kind of separation, it's very difficult and often impossible to ensure that those two facilities are, or programs are, completely equal. This has been the bane of Title IX existence. Most of the lawsuits around Title IX have to do with this. How do you achieve parity between men and women sports programs on a college campus, for example? So there's that aspect of sex segregated facilities. But there's also another sort of set of examples that I bring up in the book, which is anybody who's a parent, and I have a newborn and a toddler who's in the public sphere with kids who are a different sex than them, then you have to violate the sex segregation policies of public restrooms. You think about teachers on field trips with young kids. They have to navigate sex-segregated facilities. Anybody who's a caretaker of an elderly person or anybody who needs help using a public restroom, the sex segregation poses a real obstacle. So I argue in the book that we should design and build public restrooms much differently. I think that we have some examples of this. If you're in Philadelphia or Manhattan, a lot of restaurants have this scenario where they've just built a series of stalls where you have a floor-to-ceiling partition, so you give people their privacy, and then in the middle you have sinks and mirrors that are, you know, anybody, you know, can use. So it's an all-gender kind of gender-neutral scenario that gives people their privacy, but ends up benefiting all the groups that I just talked about. And the beauty of it, in my opinion, is that it doesn't harm anybody. So it's a kind of a universal design kind of solution that I think could actually sort of work. And what's interesting, too, is that a lot of times when I hear people who have used these gender-neutral restrooms, they don't even always realize that they're gender-neutral because they haven't been shocked or harmed in any kind of way.
Yeah, and, you know, I think this is a perfect opportunity to dive into sort of the four case studies that you use to lay out your argument. And you've been kind of touching on the sex-segregated bathrooms example, and that was one of your case studies. And I thought it was really interesting, and you were kind of bringing this up earlier, is sort of that the enforcement of these sex-segregated bathrooms aren't really about what our birth certificates say, is sort of what you argue. It's more about sort of the normative gender stereotypes, as you say, and sort of how these different, I think you use the term scripts for identity, are used in these bathrooms, right? So I was wondering, and you even go into talking about how bathrooms are even sites for sort of maintaining hegemonic masculinity, which was very interesting to me. So I was wondering if you wanted to dive into that for a little bit.
Oh, yeah, sure. And it's, let's go right to the North Carolina's bathroom bill, because I think I talk about this in the book, you start to just peel back the layers ever so slightly, you start to see what the issue really is. In that case, the legislation passed in North Carolina, which has since been rescinded, said that anybody using a public restroom in public building, and this included schools in North Carolina, had to use the sex segregated bathroom that matches what it says on their birth certificate. The assumption here is that the sex designation on a birth certificate is the original and immutable statement of our sex identity. What's really interesting and ironic is that North Carolina, along with every state except for Tennessee, allows for people to alter the sex marker on their birth certificate. So I point out that if the intention here was to exclude trans people from bathrooms, it doesn't even the law didn't even accomplish that. But from a kind of gender theory perspective, this is really interesting too, because there is this sort of, you see lawmakers on this hunt for tracking down some way of stabilizing our sex and or our gender. And in academia, we're careful about using those terms differently, but in the public discourse, they get conflated a lot. So, there's this hunt for something to pin down. You can say is the sex that we were designated at birth, but we know that that's not that can change for some people. So, what is the bill really about? If you think about how it would be enforced, it could never be enforced. It's not in any kind of practical sense. You would have to have what I call like bathroom bouncers outside of public restrooms in North Carolina, and then you would have to actually have those bathroom bouncers conduct an inspection. Number one, most of us don't carry our birth certificates on our person in the public sphere, so it's not practical from that perspective. And to match, to sort of clearly identify people, who have to undergo this kind of gender inspection that ultimately leads to our genitals. So if you really start to talk through the sort of the practicality of these policies, it takes us up into a place that nobody really wants to go, which is, I think, kind of exposes, interestingly enough, exposes sort of the unworkability of these laws. But as I point out in the book, HB2 in North Carolina really was about scaring transgender people, I think, and terrorizing us in a way. So in that sense, it doesn't have to be pragmatic or practical. It's rather kind of a public statement that we basically don't want to see transgender people in the public sphere, because that's what the state of North Carolina was saying. If you can't use a public restroom, you literally can't be in public. And I think this is another point that I really kind of hammer home in the book. I did a lot of radio and media interviews this summer about the book, and people were often very interested in talking about the bathroom issue. And it's very easy to trivialize this, to say we shouldn't be we shouldn't be talking about bathrooms, we should be talking about something more important. But in a sense, what could be more important than a public restroom? Everybody needs that basic access to actually be in the public sphere. And I talk in the book about the history of, when women were excluded from the public sphere, from work and from schools, colleges, you saw there was an absence of women's restrooms in the public sphere. And that was a clear message that they were not wanted. The same thing with African Americans, and the list goes on. When Sandra Day O'Connor became the first female justice of the Supreme Court, there was no women's restroom, and so I was listening to an interview with Hillary Clinton about her new book, and she was talking about the fact that she was late to one of the debates because she had to walk a greater distance to use a women's restroom. And Trump at a rally took this as an instance to sort of to mock her in this way. But here's another clear instance where, you know, she was saying in the interview, it was unbelievable to her that the, number one, that she had to walk a greater distance, and that the TV producers knew this, but they didn't take that into account. And so she was literally late for one of the debates because she had to walk a greater distance to find a restroom.
Yeah, and that's a really, you know, good point about sort of why this issue isn't trivial. And I think in the book you really do a great job of laying that case out. But I want to sort of step back to your first case study, because it does kind of inform, you know, especially the birth certificate part of your bathroom argument, right? So the first case study that you used are sort of these sex-marked identity documents. So what identity documents do you talk about in the book, and why is it problematic that we sort of have the sex designation on there?
Yeah, I mean, I talk about birth certificates, which are obviously the very first kind of form of a document, you know, government issued documentation, which are sex marked. And I also talk about driver's licenses and passports. The cluster of these examples, if you think about sort of what the legitimate policy goal is for the sex markers, it's basically to make sure that we are who we say we are in situations where the risk of personal, is important there, personal identity theft is high, and the consequences are grave. So here we're worried about fraud, but it's fraud based on the person, not on sex identity. And we have gender markers on all these documents, I think, just as a sort of a rote way. They were there historically, so we keep on using them in a kind of unthinking kind of way. But I want to pause and ask that question, which is in the title of the book, does gender matter here? Is gender a good proxy for personal identity? And the answer is no. It's a characteristic that we share with many, many people. It doesn't help in any kind of way, practically speaking, to narrow down our identity. We also know that sex identity is fungible. It's mutable. And so it's something that can change over time. And so if we're looking for the protection of personal identity fraud, then there are better ways to go about that. And we always kind of use the example of credit cards. Credit card companies deal with fraud constantly. It's their biggest issue. And if you notice, there are no sex markers on our credit cards, because those companies know that it's a very poor way of tracking personal identity. So they use things like passwords and, you know, chip technology and increasingly, you know, biometrics as well, which is, you know, using fingerprints and irises and, you know, to make sure that we are who we say we are. Now, I think I don't really get into those examples too much in the book. They bring their own risks, of course. But the point that I try to make is that we could get rid of these sex markers, and we wouldn't be worse off, and we would be making a lot of people's lives a lot easier if we did so by removing yet another trigger for sex identity discrimination.
And I thought this was a really important point that you make in this chapter as well, but why does adding more sex markers on these documents not necessarily help the overall problem?
Yeah, and this is really timely to bring this part of the book up, because California has just joined Oregon and D.C. in allowing people, residents of their state, to check a third gender option, which is an X, and stands in for non-binary. So you have now three sex categories in these particular locations. So this is an example of accommodation. It's very much like, you know, you think about the ADA accommodations for people with disabilities, the addition of a third bathroom, in addition to the existence of binary sex-segregated bathrooms. I think that the problem with this, again, it helps some people, but it doesn't help everybody, is that it can create a stigma. So, why should I, as a trans person, have to use a separate bathroom? Not everybody is comfortable with that. I don't think it's necessarily, you know, something that individuals want, or you could even bring safety concerns into the picture as well. And then the bigger problem, I think, is that it just doesn't do anything to deal with the ultimate source of sex identity discrimination, which is the sex classification policy itself. So that's really like the bigger point in the book, is that anytime you invoke sex or gender in a policy at whatever level, you are automatically going to have sex identity discrimination. The question is, I think, you know, about when and where it's justified. So there are times, and we could talk about it a little bit, times when I think that gender policies are justified, that the pros outweigh the cons, and that even when you have those policies, you're still going to have those kinds of discrimination.
Yeah, so to jump ahead to another case study that you use, sex-segregated colleges. So you use the example of sort of all women's colleges, or you would prefer to sort of rebrand or sort of rethink that designation. But why did you pick that as sort of one of your case studies?
Yeah, I think I started out, you know, when I was doing the research and writing the book, talking about sex-segregated education more broadly, so K-12, in addition to colleges and universities. And I still would like to focus and write about K-12 sex segregation. I think the age difference, you know, is interesting to consider there. But I focused on women's colleges because they've been at the center, especially the most prestigious ones, have been at the center of some high-profile cases where, in particular, trans women have applied to women's colleges and encountered obstacles, either been rejected or been given a hard time as far as admission standards go. So, and then there's the other issue about somebody who is accepted into a women's college as female, but then transitions to male over the course of their time at the school. So in response to these challenges, places like Mount Holyoke and Mills and Barnard and Smith and Wellesley have had to respond in some kind of way. And so I was interested in the various responses. To make a long story short, Mount Holyoke is the school that has gone the furthest in making adjustments. And so their policy currently is really interesting because their admissions process is open to anybody except for one group of people, and the one group of people that can't apply are people who were designated as male at birth and identify as male at the time of their application. This is interesting to me that this particular group has been excluded, and you can understand why. There are a lot of legitimate arguments to say that women's colleges have served a really important corrective function in our society for providing opportunities for young women to be in leadership positions and be in academic environments. We all know that discussion dynamics are highly gendered, and so there are a lot of important kind of benefits that women's colleges, you know, have accrued over the years. I would like to see them continue in their mission, but to formally open their admissions policies to anyone. And it would be the details of that, I think, are tricky to sort of think through. But I use the analogy of historically Black colleges. I think that it might be time to talk about historically women's colleges, to say that the mission is important and the history is important, but that as a matter of gender equity and equal protection of the laws, I think that women's colleges have to open their doors to anyone.
And I think a really interesting point that I got out of this case study was that it seems as though the different colleges sort of have they're not radically different policies, but they're certainly different policies in terms of how they handle admissions, right? So a point that you bring up in the book is that when schools are sort of dealing with admissions in this sort of like individual case-by-case basis, it seemed almost not inevitable, but it seemed very frequent that in their response to somebody applying that is either, you know, transitioning at the time or was designated male at birth and now identifies as female, it seems as though they use this sort of in-house litmus test of femininity. And I wondered if you wanted to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it gets really, really interesting, you know, once you start to ask the question about, again, and it's the question that I ask for each case study, is gender rationally related to some legitimate policy goal? I mean, that's the basic framework of anti-discrimination law in general. And we have, you know, when we talk about race, the highest standard of scrutiny is given to race. So like a school like a college can't invoke race unless it has a very good reason for doing so. And it certainly can't force people to self-identify racially. But for gender, there's a lower kind of legal standard. I think we should actually have, you know, apply strict scrutiny to gender as well. But yes, getting back to your question, then it gets this question of what's the definitional criteria for being a woman? You know, and is it, you know, like, are we talking about biological features here? Are we talking about experience? It's not ultimately clear. I think that there are sort of the most compelling kind of arguments for the existence of women's colleges is that that young women applying have been subjected to societal sexism and have had to contend with that and have different responses, but that might, you know, is a common experience. Things get interesting then when you're talking about somebody who either is designated as female at birth and maybe lives X number of years as female and then transitions to male. How much "quote unquote" female experience is necessary to qualify to be a "quote unquote" real woman. It's a those are very tough questions to ask and to answer. And I think that the ultimate answer is that that you can't institute criteria in that way. You can talk about your goals about combating sexism and creating a certain kind of collegial environment, a college experience that is geared toward combating sexism. But I don't think that you can have official criteria for who's male and who's female in a college admissions process or in any kind of policy process. Anytime you do that again, you're going to have gender identity discrimination.
Yeah, and part of the reason that you point out why these remain sort of tough questions is that in any sort of legal precedent or court case that deals with sex or gender discrimination, the courts usually don't define sex or gender in the case, which kind of remains like a problem when confronting these case studies, right?
Absolutely. And it's such an important point. I think that most people who are not sort of like, you know, studying this stuff in academia might not kind of fully register to them. But yes, the Supreme Court, if you look at its decisions over time, totally conflates gender and sex, uses these terms interchangeably all of the time. And we have yet to get a court case that really talks about gender or sex as a mutable characteristic. And I use that term because immutability has been the standard that the Supreme Court really has used over time, you know, to talk about racial discrimination and then sex discrimination. So one of the reasons that the court has given for treating, you know, racial policies with such a strict scrutiny is because most often, historically, when race has been invoked, it's been used in a discriminatory way by public officials and by government. And also the assumption that it's an immutable characteristic that we're born with and that we can't change, and so that we shouldn't punish people or something about them that they have no control over. Then that analogy was made to sex and gender, but now we have a very trans experience, intersex experience, which we should talk about as well, throws a wrench into that narrative. So we just know that that's, while it's true that for the majority of people, sex is immutable, meaning that they have, or it's consistent, they don't change that aspect of their identities over the course of their lifetime. But for some people, they do. And some people are born with intersex conditions, which are physiological, you know, in nature, that but they can't be you know, categorized as male or female at birth, given the classificatory system that we use.
And kind of moving into your last case study, which is sports sex segregation. Sort of before we jump into that specific case, I think this is a good point to sort of talk about. You began to talk about intersex and how that plays a role in sort of your argument, but also sort of the intersection of race as well. So I don't know if you want to get into that, and then sort of that, I feel like that transitions easily to your sports case study.
Sure. I whenever we're talking about sex classifications, games, which again always have to be interpreted and applied by some kind of administrative agent, whether that's a customer service person, a bus driver, you know, a principal, a teacher, an admissions officer, a manager at a restaurant, anybody who's enforcing those policies has to make those decisions. When we're talking about sex identity discrimination, it's often a visual kind of thing that we're talking about, and it's often visceral. So gender is probably one of the first things that we notice about another human being in our society. when we're noticing somebody, we're also taking in their race, especially in this country. So racial perception is always gendered and vice versa. So in going right back to the case of Charlene Arcilla, who, African-American transgender woman, when she was told that she wasn't a real woman, she was implicit there was that she wasn't a real Black woman. So race is always intertwined. It's always intersecting. And again, I think that as like in academia, we talk about intersectionality a lot, and now we're sort of starting to talk about that more so in the public sphere. When it comes to sports, and I leave this case study to the very end of the book because I think it's the hardest case study, because there are sex-related features that do bestow a competitive advantage. And testosterone has become sort of the measure of sex identity in the realm of elite sports. The current policy that the International Olympic Committee uses, and also NCAA Division I sports, is the measurement of testosterone, functional testosterone, specifically for athletes who want to compete as female. So there's no corresponding test for athletes wishing to compete as male, but there is for those who want to compete as female. So if you're an athlete who wants to compete as female, your testosterone levels have to be lower than the average range for men. So just briefly, this brings me to the case of Caster Semenya, who is a Black South African mid-distance runner who has been dominant in track and field. Accused of being really a man because of her muscularity and her appearance. It turns out that she has an intersex condition where her body produces more testosterone than the average female. And this is something that it's a minority kind of experience, but others share as well. So that's sort of, I think it's interesting in the sports world because this brings us right to the body. Looking for sex in the body. And what does that look like? Is it muscularity? Is it the tone of one's voice? Does it really just boil down to testosterone? Is that the best way of drawing distinctions here? And so the conclusion that I come to in the book is that it makes more sense to scrutinize these things more so at elite levels than it does at recreational levels. So I think we're seeing a lot of this too when it comes to youth sports and also like adult recreational sports, the sort of the breaking down of some of the sex binaries when it comes to the athletic play and competition.
And I know that you bring up the example in the book of the Williams sisters in tennis. And I was a tennis player in high school. So when I was reading this chapter, I started thinking about sort of there are a lot of examples in that sport specifically, right? So you have not only sort of the characterizations that have been lumped upon the Williams sisters, but also, you know, we're having the Hollywood movie remake or first attempt, I'm not sure, of the Battle of the Sexes tennis match, yeah. Right? Yeah. I'm wondering, now that we're talking, you know, it seems like we have examples, if we're just looking at this one sport, of, you know, the competitive balance argument seems to fall apart a little bit quicker in tennis as an example. Mm-hmm. But yet you still have, you know, John McEnroe, I believe this was last year, saying that Serena Williams wouldn't even be ranked in the top 100 of men, which is kind of ludicrous. But do you think that, why is it that even though we may see evidence of more parity or less or more competitive balance? Why is it that we're still unable to sort of get past it at sort of the professional level?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think because there's more going on with something like professional tennis than just who is sort of the best when it comes to strength and endurance and skill. There's also what we as fans want to consume when it comes to these sports. Claudia Rankine has written really eloquently about Serena Williams and her sort of marketability. And that has been hampered by the fact that she is African-American and dark-skinned African-American woman. And she compares to Maria Sharapova, who is, Serena is clearly the better player, but Maria Sharapova continues to be much more marketable because she's a tall, blonde, white woman. And, Claudia Rankine talks about sort of, tennis representing, representations of the good life and who embodies that. So it's a lot of sort of like emotionality about, who's watching and what we want to purchase, I think. And the Williams sisters have been really, really interesting in that whole narrative because, of course, they come, from a very different experience and have broken a lot of the rules and have, risen to the top in spite of it all. But things would look very differently if they were white. So I don't know. There's a lot going on there. It's interesting, too, that some studies show that actually, female athletes have greater endurance than men. And so tennis is interesting because in the Grand Slams, women, men play longer matches than women do. So it's complicated. I think it's sports specific. I think it's level specific. I think we have to come to terms with the marketing of sports and what we want to consume. You think about the NFL, for example, which is interesting because the NFL, like any major league sport in this country, is not officially sex segregated. So they, but at the same time, we've only seen women as kickers very sporadically. It's a very masculine sport. It kind of goes back to, I guess some of your work on masculinity and so on. But questioning what we want to purchase, I think, as consumers of sport is really important too, and how our gender-specific demands.
Yeah, and, I think that when you were kind of beginning the conversation into this case study and saying how this was sort of the hardest one, I think that for people reading it, I know that anecdotally I have heard sort of the competitive fairness argument a lot in this discussion. But I think that the way that you present it in this chapter is, I think, really helpful to those that really want to think deeper about that issue. But I know I've taken a lot of your time, so I just have a couple closing questions. If you were to have somebody read your book and have one takeaway, sort of one main thing that you would hope kind of sticks, what would that be?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm glad you asked it. I would like for the takeaway, somebody who reads the book, to think about the organizations that they are a part of, whether it's the workplace, a club that they belong to, a sports organization. I would like for them to think about when and where gender is encoded in a policy. I have these worksheets at the end of the book. I call this gender audit. And I do this with companies and organizations when I do consulting work. And it ends up being a fun kind of practice, actually, where we kind of do it, take an inventory of gender policies in that particular venue, and then ask that question, is it necessary? If so, why? If not, maybe we should get rid of it. And if maybe we could replace it with something else. So that would be the takeaway, to have a look at the worksheets in the back, think about that question, think about a conversation, you know, conversation they might have with coworkers, or just something that they might do differently in terms of their own practice. And so I think it's just basic questioning gender policies wherever they are. And it could be something as small as, you know, thinking about the gendered honorifics that they use. You know, is it necessary to use sir and ma'am when referring to people, to be polite and treat them with courtesy, or could they be avoided? To something bigger, like whether the bathrooms are sex segregated where I work, and whether that needs to be the case.
Right. And I think that, you know, for those listening that might be in academia, even, you know, not just doing a gender audit of your university or college, but even, you know, your department, I think can be very useful.
Yes. And even your classroom policies. So thinking about ways to make your classrooms more gender inclusive, trans inclusive. I do this thing in a lot of my classes where I pass around index cards at the beginning of the semester, and I talk about gender identity, and I allow students to self-identify on the index card. I don't think it's perfect, but it is at least one attempt to kind of interrupt this sort of momentum that we all have of just invoking gender in the way that we refer to people and in the way that we carry out things in the public sphere.
Right. And the last question I want to leave our listeners with is, are there any books or, you know, could be articles even, that if people are interested in your book, you know, they pick it up and they are really enamored with it, what would you recommend that they also check out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think the work of Paisley Kura is excellent, and he has a book that's going to be coming out with NYU Press, but also has several articles, has been writing about from a political theory and policy perspective, issues around transgender lives, and also is the founder and editor of Transgender Studies Quarterly, the journal, which people should check out. I think also just in political science, the work of Jamie Taylor and Andrew Flores, doing really interesting empirical work around these issues. So those would be some of the things that kind of come immediately to mind within sort of the academic realm.
Well, thank you for those recommendations. And I will say the first recommendation will be to check out your book, Beyond Trans, Does Gender Matter? It was a great read, and I couldn't recommend it highly enough. But Professor, thank you for joining the New Books Network today.
Thank you so much. It's been great.